Hi, this is Peter Laws from the Flicks the Church Forgot. You're just about to listen to an audio version of a video episode that's currently up on YouTube where I review the film The Witch. If you'd like to listen to the audio version, it's coming up soon, straight away in fact, but if you would prefer to see pictures and video and that sort of stuff, then just toddle over to YouTube and skip the audio and you can see a video version if you would like. Thank you. Hi everybody, my name is Peter Laws and this is the Flicks the Church Forgot, the show where I explore the deeper and occasionally spiritual themes of horror movies. Now you can follow me on Twitter if you like, at Rev Peter Laws, or on Facebook at the Flicks the Church Forgot page, or you can check out my monthly horror column in the 14 Times Air magazine. Also, you may not be aware, but this show actually began as an audio podcast, and so there's a whole bunch of audio episodes available through theflicksthechurchforgot.com. And if you prefer your horror thoughts on the move, then the audio of this video, along with my other YouTube stuff, is available in podcast form, should you wish to not stare at my soul-burning eyes for too long. And of course, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel for more horror reviews, videos, and bizarre cover versions of classic horror movie songs. Oh yes. But without further ado, let's turn our attention to the first episode in a four-part series that I'm doing on witchcraft, horror, and Christianity. Tonight we're going to be exploring why goats are inherently creepy in the American folktale, The Witch. I played John Proctor once in a school production of Arthur Miller's Witchfest, The Crucible. Now, for those of you who may not be aware of this is a seminal play about the famous witch trials of Salem, Massachusetts. Now, it was, as most people probably know, a veiled critique of the McCarthy witch hunts of the 1950s, where Hollywood stars were being named and shamed and blacklisted as communists. But while this 50s political subtext of The Crucible was, it was fascinating, for me, I was always way more interested in the backwoods shenanigans of the Salem witch trials 1692, which is what the film is about, what the play is about. It's an exciting and brilliant play, which I really enjoyed, and so it was cool to have it at school. And the school eventually decided to dramatize this play for an audience, and I somehow got the lead part of John Proctor. This is insane, okay? Because my acting talent is about as effective as my ability to get pregnant. But it wasn't to be anyway, because the drama teacher eventually cancelled the show at the last minute because most of the supporting cast, most of the other my fellow students, didn't know their lines. To be fair, it was probably wise that they did that, because hearing thick Geordie accents from the Northeast, hearing thick Geordie accents say things like, "Tituba danced with the devil, she wrote in the devil's book, man. It's all about Satan." It would have made the play a little bit comedy anyway. But anyway, decades later, the ghost of the Crucible walks again. The clash of Puritans and witchcraft is back, only this time the 17th century accents are pitch perfect, and this is very, very little. Got very little to laugh about. I'm talking, of course, about Robert Eggers' film, The Witch. Now, The Witch opens in a village courtroom where a religiously devout father will not accept the Christian credentials of the community leaders. It's a really important scene in the film, which sets up one of the key features of the film, but also of Protestant religion, which is what the Puritans were, by the way. They were Protestants. Now, namely, Protestantism was a reaction against what you would call like a sort of top-down authority of the Catholic Church, which they perceived. And so they felt popes and bishops maybe telling Christians what to do and maybe not having, and maybe being hypocritical about it, and so they tried to remove and purify all Catholic influence from the church. It was all part of a wider Protestant message, which was almost like a sort of power to the people message, saying that the individual had the right to not only interpret the Bible in their own way, but also to directly challenge religious authorities in their interpretation of the Bible. And so that's exactly what goes on here at the very beginning of this this film. This individual Christian, William, feels empowered to make his own decisions about God and faith and directly challenges authority. You know what? I've read historians who say that it was this Protestant approach to personal authority that led to a revolution in art, culture, and politics that we see still today. What they argue is, like, for example, if you're an atheist, firstly, welcome. But if you are an atheist, and you will happily criticize and dismantle religious arguments publicly, which is, of course, your right. some scholars would argue that you, ironically, may owe some of the freedom of expression and disagreement to religious movement on the Protestant Revolution, which made it possible for you to have that individual opinion to do it. But, of course, there will be Catholic scholars who may argue against that. Anyway, going back to 1692, this man has his own interpretation of the Bible and the way we should interpret Christianity. And so he clashes with his community leaders and he's cast out. But he refuses to agree with them. And he goes out with his wife and his five children. But the man's devout. He is hopeful that he can build a new life for himself and his family because, after all, the Spirit of God is with him, isn't he? Seeing this family venture out to make a life for themselves in the film is a pretty sobering reminder of how humble the American dream used to be. Build a house, get some livestock, honor God. In many ways, the plight of the 17th century family that we see here is echoed in every family that has ever been, including mine and maybe yours. A sort of us against the world vibe. We're stepping out on our own. We're going to try and work hard and grow the crops, as it were, in our life, and hopefully we'll make a success of our lives. And this is what they try to do. They set out to plow new ground, but time and again, no matter how much they honor God, God does not seem to be playing ball at all, as they say. He seems to refuse to honor them back. The crops don't yield. When they hunt, they can barely find any prey. The wife, Catherine, she quickly freaks out. She's seeing the pointlessness of the situation. She pleads with William to return to the village, that he should swallow his religious pride and go back to the community where their kids at least can eat. They maybe can survive this harsh new world of America. It's land of opportunity, not, it seems to them. So very soon, this attempt to step out of the authority of the local community has bad consequences, and which it gets solidified in one of the film's signature moments early on. Thomason, a name I've never heard before, but I really like. Thomason, the teenage daughter and eldest kid. She's playing peekaboo with the youngest baby called Samuel when she pulls her hand back for one more boo, and there's an empty space where the kid was. You're like, it's probably the closest this movie ever gets to the sort of trailer-friendly horror set piece you'd see in films like The Conjuring. So the family, very early on, are stricken with this tragic mystery. Where on earth has baby Samuel gone? Was it a wolf that took him away? My God, have even whisked him off in some sort of punishment of William's arrogance? Or might the answer be simple? What if there is a witch in the wood? Now, the critics aren't lying. This is an unsettling film with images that I've filed away for future nightmares. Man, the bit with the raven, I just yelped out loud. And there were frequent moments when I watched this film in this position. That, I think, my friends, is a good sign for a horror film. However, it's the constant throb of dread, danger, and melancholy that probably casts the film's strongest spell. The location is horribly drab and depressing, with washed out colour and hard, muddy ground, with this rickety little farmhouse overshadowed by massively tall trees. It's a clear signal that these human beings are ultimately at the mercy of nature. And so to have a witch who can control and manipulate nature itself, well, she becomes a very formidable neighbour indeed. But it's not just the location and cinematography that works. It's the family and religious drama that really is the sort of the fuel of the film. Indeed, it could be argued that this isn't a horror film at all, I suppose, but it's sort of like a group version of Roman Polanski's Repulsion, a family isolated from others, slowly losing their marbles. The film does work on all of these multiple levels, and I'm quite happy to accept readings of The Witch as being basically hallucinations of a family driven mad by stress and starvation, that there isn't really any supernatural element. Who knows, maybe they're all dead and Thomason is the last one alive, but she's witnessing all of this through her own dying death trip. Maybe. But what I really like about The Witch is that the supernatural metaphysical reading of the story is just as strong, if not more so. I'd say it's more strong. In other words, what I'm saying is this might be an arty end of the spectrum movie, but you can still watch this film as a straight-up horror flick. You won't feel like the filmmakers at the end are winking come the credits, saying, you know, we only use witches as a sort of like, symbol for social commentary in the same way Arthur Miller did in The Crucible. No, in this, you're actually thinking, man, there is legit witchery going on here. Maybe that's why some of the reviewers have said that The Witch feels like a movie you shouldn't be watching. Warnings against watching something is a perfect way to sell a horror film, or indeed a horror novel. I remember a book called House of Leaves by Mark Danielewski, and the dedication page in that simply says, "This is not for you." If I read a dedication page like that, I want to read the book. So there's something instantly attractive about the idea of a film or a novel that's forbidden, which is in essence what this film is about, the attraction to the forbidden. So I'm not surprised to find the draw for many people has been that this film feels like it has a sense of danger around it. This view, of course, was stoked by the religious and political protest group, the Temple of Satan, who publicly endorsed the movie. The Witch, they argued, is more than a film. They said it is a transformative satanic experience. Now, just in case you're not sure, and especially if you're a Christian out there and may not be aware of this, it may be helpful to know that the Temple of Satan don't, as far as I can tell, actually believe Satan is a literal supernatural entity. He's more of a literary, symbolic figurehead, which is actually the case for many mainstream Satanists, including some that I've met. You know, the horror movie image of like Satanists and goat head masks and stuff worshipping and adoring the actual biblical person of Lucifer, they may well exist somewhere, but as far as I can tell, mainstream Satanism is not that. It's more about using Satan as a symbol of personal liberation and breaking free from the shackles of religious oppression. Ironically, some of the same principles that fueled the Protestant Revolution itself, which I talked about at the beginning. However, the average moviegoer probably not going to be aware of the nuances of Satanism, and so they might assume that, oh my word, it's Satanism. That's like sacrifice kids to the goat of Mendes. And so therefore, if they hear that it's a Satanist-backed film, they might feel that there's risk involved in watching it and that there might be the devil himself in this Blu-ray. Now, this is maybe just marketing savvy, of course, that the Satanist guy's got on board. Often when you have some sort of sense of curse about a horror film, it does make a difference, you know, like even though, you know, you never get a curse rumor about like a romantic comedy or anything, but you do about certain films, like there was a curse on the set. However, I don't think that the Satan are being completely disingenuous by getting behind the film, because I would say that the film does have, in many ways, a satanic message. Now, I'm a Christian, and so when you hear me say a sentence like that, you might misunderstand what I'm saying here. I am not standing here saying, this film is satanic, it is devilish, you must not watch it because it's got a satanic heart and it's going to warp you. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I mean to say is that it represents the ethos of mainstream Satanism in, I think, a really effective and interesting way. That's what I mean why it's got a satanic message. I'm not surprised, therefore, that they got behind it, because the film is a celebration of breaking free from a Christianity that can be perceived as a prison, as a straitjacket for humanity. It makes a lot of sense in that way. Now, perhaps because this film had such a strong reputation and a brilliantly unnerving trailer, I saw the trailer, I got totally freaked out by it. When the goat stands up, oh man, there's not one behind me now, is there? Watch out for something behind me. I'm just out in the church by myself, and keep watching the back in case anything creeps up on me. Anyway, maybe this is why. So the film had such a reputation that lots of people who actually went to see the film were mightily disappointed, even asking for their money back, saying that basically the film was not scary in any way and that it was all hype. I had a friend at the church, I have a friend at the church who I saw the trailer for this, and I told her about this and encouraged her to go and see it. And so she did, but she came out thoroughly unimpressed, and she said it was a massive disappointment, and her issues had nothing to do with the fact that she was a Christian, but rather that she loved horror movies and she simply felt that this was not working for her as a horror movie. Now for me, okay, I agree that there were one or two scenes where my mind wandered a little bit. There is admittedly a lot of downbeat conversations about crops and farming sort of techniques in antiquated English. However, for the most of this movie, my heart was at exercise level. The sense of dread was palpable, the crumbling family was gripping and upsetting, and the horror elements, such as the woodland scenes of the witch herself, man, I think they worked on levels that were far deeper than the jump scares that maybe many people prefer. And the very ending, the very, very last shot in particular, I thought was fantastically effective. It summed up perfectly the message of the film, this liberation message. Now, you may or may not be aware that I'm an ordained church minister myself, and so I reckon there'll be many of my fellow Christians seeing this film and will label it automatically as blasphemous. But I wonder if some churches would do well to skip this week's sermon and play The Witch instead. Okay, I'm being a little facetious, right? But the reason I say that is because I think the film is a sucker punch reminder of how a graceless, sin-obsessed interpretation of Christianity leads to disillusioned believers seeking spirituality elsewhere. It is no mistake that the only real laughter and delight you see in this film has a satanic source. sadly for many people, their experience at a Christian church has been a little bit like hanging out with this Puritan family for a week. You know, for some of you guys who are watching this now, your only experience of churchy types have been those who have painted God as some sort of heartless slave owner who wants to chastise you constantly, or who wants to rip your personality away in a bid to make you more like a Robert Powell version of Jesus. You know, he's really glum all the time. And in that scenario, I can understandably think, well, maybe you wouldn't want that. Who would want to be like Jesus if it's about sapping all the color out of life? I remember this myself, you know, when I first considered Christianity in my very early 20s. The fact that so many Christians told me I had to stop watching horror films, that it was a problem for me to watch that. And to be honest, them telling me I shouldn't watch them, that was the problem, because that was part of my personality. It is part of my personality. And I felt that to deny that sort of spooky side of myself meant that I'd have to become someone I wasn't, and therefore Christianity could not possibly fit for me. And I think many people out there dismiss Christianity because they assume it will not fit for their personalities. Of course, now I believe that even within horror you can find fingerprints of God, hence a program, a show on YouTube like this, exploring the spiritual side of scary movies. But sadly, Christians who run from the world and hide from popular culture as if it's the devil's kingdom, who might say things like you must only listen to Christian music or worship music or should only watch Christian films, they approach this this way of dealing with the world by retreating from it. But I think that does a lot of damage to outsiders looking in. For too many people, God is presented basically as the ultimate party pooper, which leaves the devil as the poster boy, whether he's literal or symbolic, the poster boy for liberation and getting the best out of life. In the witch, it's ultimately Satan who does promise that we might live deliciously. And that's a brilliant quotable line. While God is either silent in this film the implied message is that he wants us to live the opposite of deliciously, that God condemns us into a life of sensual starvation. No wonder, therefore, that the box that's marked God in Christianity seems like a crummy version to pick. And so I'm not surprised that Thomason wants to break free of her Puritan family and their faith. But I'd add that it's very ironic when you read the words of Jesus himself, who was the figurehead of Christianity, because in the Gospels, I think he would not recognize the joyless Christianity we see in this film. If you read the Gospels, you don't see a guy who's advocating that we strip all enjoyment and pleasure from life. You actually see a man who's at parties and turning water into wine and like hanging out with rejected retrobates, being accused of drunkenness and wildness, even at one point being accused of being demonically possessed. Eventually, of course, being executed for his revolutionary political ideas and then still forgiving his murderers. All I'm saying is his lifestyle does not reflect that of the uber-retreatist Puritans. But also what Jesus said is the opposite of what we see in the witch family as well. At one point in the book of John, Jesus argues that he came to give us life in all its fullness. The aim of God, therefore, is not to slam our personalities into the dirt and take away our passions. Rather, it's the flip side of that. It's to encourage us to embrace life and live it, like, to the max, as it were. To the max. Yeah, there may be some rules of thumb to follow, like, you know, like, don't murder, don't treat people like crap, forgive others. But these apparent restrictions aren't there to make life tedious and boring. They're supposed to liberate human beings from the selfishness that so often results in a small, pathetic, and lonely life. Believe me, man, I've met plenty of guys who have liberated themselves and lived with not any thought to other people. And some of them right now are either dead from overdoses, some of my friends, they're locked up in prison, or they've lost any sort of access to their children. All I'm saying is, like, their brief nights of personal liberation have been hopelessly short-lived. And it's kind of shackled them in chains for the rest of their days. To me, that doesn't sound like living life deliciously. It's no mistake, therefore, that straight after Jesus comes and says he wants us to live life in its fullness, he says that the thief, that's the devil he's referring to, came to steal, kill, and destroy. But what the witch does brilliantly is it shows how life can often feel the exact opposite of what Jesus says. That our culture, and sometimes Christians, make us feel like it's God who is belittling us. It's God who wants to take away our humanity, that he's on this constant quest to keep us down and sort of dismantle who we are. But the devil is the only fella who wants to lift us up high. And I loved how the witch showed that both figuratively and literally. That was a brilliant symbol in the film. So what we're left with is basically the same message, God's a party pooper, that the serpent gave Adam and Eve in Genesis, in the paradise garden. Whether that happened in history or was a literary symbol, it doesn't really matter much to me. But the witch, I think, is a chilling reminder of what a beguiling argument that is from the serpent's mouth. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that according to the Bible, it's ironically Jesus who comes and promises that we might live deliciously and taste the very best out of life. Yet in practice, and you may know this from personal experience, human beings are most fulfilled and content. Life feels its most delicious in some ways when we reach out to others in love and compassion. Let me explain. How do you feel when you help someone out? Compare that to how you feel when you've treated them like dirt. You know, when we use other people as stepping stones to pleasure, we don't necessarily experience life in all its fullness. We can actually risk ending up lonely and depressed. That's not a very delicious way of living. Look at A Christmas Carol by Dickens. Perhaps that's why most of the witches I've met, interestingly, and I've recently interviewed quite a few of them for a magazine article I wrote, which I'm going to share in a related video later in the series. Perhaps that's why most witches I meet share a really quite a similar outlook to Christians, a sense that life is at its most balanced and beautiful when we try to do good to others. That is not to say that we have to live a life of constant denial and that we never embrace life, or indeed that we never have selfish moments as well. We need them. We're human beings. But the message is like we do get lasting pleasure from altruism rather than selfishness. And I just find it interesting how so many witches and religious people and frankly many atheist friends that I have share this kind of worldview. By the way, you can tune into the bonus episode, which is coming on, not the second one, but the third one, where I interview a practicing witch about how they're portrayed in horror. And you'll find that, you know, they're as nice as anyone else, really. But I